education necessary to forge a successful career defending criminals. Frank's record over the first 2 years of his career had been good enough to land him a job at Garrison Ford, one of Chicago's largest and most accomplished criminal defense firms. He joined in the summer of 1979 with grand visions, monumental goals, and a true passion for protecting the rights of those who sought his help. Had someone told Frank Moore back then that he'd spend most of his career running a one-man shop far from the spotlight of Garrison Ford's high-profile cases, he'd have never believed them. He was young and hungry and filled with fire. Nothing was going to get in his way. That is, until he was assigned to the case that would change his life forever. The summer of 79 had been plagued by the disappearances of 6 women, and the city was on edge. When the police found their man, Frank's phone rang. His boss, a partner in the firm, needed his help on a sensitive case. A man named Thomas Mitchell, who had notoriously been dubbed the thief, had hired Garrison Ford to defend him against the charge of killing his wife. For a high-profile firm, it didn't get much better. Frank Moore, young and bright and ambitious, would do the scut work of research and briefs. He jumped at the opportunity. Over the following 2 years, between the summer of 1979 and the fall of 1981, the case took nasty and insurmountable turns. In the end, Garrison Ford had presented a failed defense of Thomas Mitchell, and the thief was sentenced to 60 years for the murder of his wife. After the trial, Frank Moore became lead counsel on Thomas Mitchell's appeals. It was during the appeals process, when Frank met often with his client to discuss strategy, he first started to believe Thomas Mitchell's wife might be alive.
"I've filed the notice of appeal," Frank said. "Next, I'll finish my brief and submit it in the next week or 10 days.
"And the brief goes after her?" Thomas Mitchell asked. They were seated in a private interview room at Stateville Correctional Center, which was reserved for privileged attorney-client meetings. Frank was on one side of the table and his client, handcuffed and orange jumpsuited, on the other. Frank knew it was possible that someone from the prison was listening to their conversation, but not likely, and he didn't really care.
"It goes after how the defense obtained the alleged evidence against you. It goes after the judge's decision to allow that evidence to be presented in court."
"Good. Go after the judge and go after the evidence, but go after her, too. She was having a nervous breakdown when she did this to me. She was swallowing Valium at 3 times the rate it had been prescribed. Plus, mentally, she was not all there."
"We have a lot of ammunition, Thomas. My first brief will be based mostly on the legality of the evidence presented against you, the complete circumstantiality of it all, and the argument that none of it should have been allowed in court. If our initial appeal is denied, and there is a very good chance it will be, then our next appeal will include details about your wife's mental state when she disappeared. Remember, the appeals process allows us to continue to the federal level through the writ of habeas corpus if needed. And there's a lot of work to be done on the state level before we even consider that route. Hopefully someone in their right mind within the appeals court makes the sound and just decision about this. So I'll make a strong opening argument in this initial appeal to the state. But we'll save details about your wife for later if we need them, including the fact that you were convicted of second-degree murder without the prosecution producing a body."
"They can't produce a body because there is no body. Where are you on that? Any progress?" Frank gathered some papers and placed them into his bag, pulled out a different stack and looked at it.
"Her parents were a dead end. They hadn't seen her for many years before she disappeared. Only a few times since she turned 18, they told me."
"Could you read them?" Thomas asked. "You didn't get a sense that they were lying to you?"
"They weren't lying."
"She had to have help. A woman like Angela, she doesn't just go off on her own. She'd be too scared. Sometimes she couldn't bring herself to leave the house.
Now I'm supposed to believe she up and vanished all on her own.
No, someone helped her. Someone is still helping her.
Her parents are the most likely ones. Did you tell them you were looking for her?
Thomas.
Frank put his elbows on the table and leaned closer to his client.
They were very upset. They believe, like the rest of the country, that Angela is dead.
I didn't tell them who I was or that I thought their daughter was still alive. I made up a story about the possibility of a civil suit.
Maybe you should have told them what you're really after.
That's not the right approach. They believe their daughter is dead. I'm not going to fill them with false hope that she's alive.
It's not false. She's alive.
Frank nodded his head.
But I'm not the one to tell them that. I'll conduct my search for her the way I think is best.
Did you talk with Catherine?
Catherine Blackwell, your business partner's wife.
Yes, I visited her a couple of weeks ago. She's still very distraught at the mention of you or Angela. We didn't have a fruitful conversation.
Do you believe me?
Frank stared at his client, convicted of killing his wife, accused of killing many more, and paused too long before he answered.
I'm looking for her, aren't I? If I didn't believe you, do you think I'd be spending all my time on this? And by the way, I've got to start billing for my time.
I've got money.
It's going to be expensive.
I'll pay you whatever it costs to find her.
But I want you to do this quietly.
Don't involve your firm. I'll pay you separately.
I haven't even told my wife what I'm doing. Do you think I'm about to tell the partners at Garrison Ford?
On the record, you and I are working on your appeals.
Off the record, you're retaining my services independently to look into a personal matter, settle your debts, handle your finances, negotiate your way out of the business you still technically co-own, deal with your property, etc. I'll write up the paperwork.
What's next?
The thief asked.
I'll file the notice of appeal this week.
No! What next with your search for her?
Oh, Frank said, collecting his papers to leave.
The psychiatric facility where she spent her teen years.
Chapter 21. Chicago, October 28, 2019. Lane Phillips stoked the dying embers and brought the orange glowing logs back to life. He stacked two more splinters of wood on top, watched the flames grow, and sat on the couch where his laptop was open. Rory was next to him, her own computer on her lap as she typed away. Fall had come quickly, descending on them from the heavens as cold Canadian air swept across the Midwest to send temperatures into the 40s. It felt too soon to turn on the heat, so they opted for their first fire of the season.
So your father was forever tied to this man, and now you are too?
Not forever, Rory said, but for at least 18 months. I'll represent him at the final hearing, review all the stipulations one more time, and hand him off to his parole officer. The judge ordered me to look after his finances with monthly reports for a year and a half, since he's got a solid nest egg stashed away and my father was listed as the financial power of attorney. So I'll make sure he doesn't go broke. Then he's on his own.
And why the order to go out to Starved Rock?
The judge waived the requirement to live in a halfway house due to his notoriety. He inherited a cabin near Starved Rock in the 90s from an uncle. My father put it in a trust and handed it off to a management company. The property has been a vacation rental for all these years. He's going to live there. So the judge ordered me to tag along with the social worker and the parole officer to have a look at the place ahead of the release. Make sure it meets all the requirements.
I'm going with you, Lane said.
Rory hadn't told Lane about her meeting with Catherine Blackwell. She allowed him to believe her nervousness had started with her visit to Stateville Correctional Center. It was a logical conclusion, as compared to the real source of Rory's distress, that her father had been trying to find Angela Mitchell before he died. And more troubling than the discovery itself was what it was doing to Rory. That walled-off place in her mind had been disturbed, the once calm waters clouded now with muck and filth. The only way to restore clarity was to figure out what her father had found. The only way to tame those waters back to peace and to quiet that place in her mind was to look for Angela herself. To ignore this urge was to stoke the flames of a sickness she had managed to control for many years. She knew the best way to extinguish the impulse was to nurture it, like Aunt Greta had taught her as a child when Rory diffused her fanatical impulses by mastering the detailed craft of restoring china dolls. The burning question now, though, was if Rory would be reconstructing the woman's death or following the footsteps of a woman who was still very much alive. "Fine," Rory said. "Come with me." She looked up from her laptop and offered a rare glimpse of emotion. "Thanks. I didn't want to go alone." A pang of guilt prickled her neck for keeping her secret from Lane. The man had done nothing more than love her and all of her flaws for the better part of a decade. Didn't he deserve to hear this part of her life? Perhaps so, but she couldn't bring herself to tell him. Rory pointed to Lane's computer, then looked back to her own. "Let's go. We're way behind. What have you got?" Lane continued to stare for a moment, as if he sensed something more she wasn't saying. Rory felt his stare, but kept her attention on the laptop.
"Okay,"
Lane said, giving in and looking at his own computer monitor. He scrolled through the pages.
"I've been watching an area outside of Detroit, southeast portion of the city and into the adjoining counties. It's been coming up on the algorithm. Several hits in just the last 4 months. There have been 12 homicides in the last 2 years where the victims have been homeless women or prostitutes, all African American. Little or no family support. A few who were only identified at the morgue through fingerprinting and matching to the Michigan Fingerprint Identification Program of convicted criminals. Basically, no one knew they had been killed. No family, no friends."
Rory was typing on her computer. "Easy targets with little risk."
"Correct," Lane said.
"How did the algorithm pick them up?"
"Manner of death."
Each week, Lane and Rory ran through trends picked up by the algorithm Lane had created. It took into account several different factors about crimes reported from across the country, looking for trends and similarities. Doing so allowed them to recognize commonalities between homicides in a particular geographic region. When enough markers and tags showed up in the same location, Lane and Rory were alerted. Then they jumped in and started digging. To date, the Murder Accountability Project had identified 12 serial killers, defined as a single person having committed at least 3 homicides across America in which arrests were made. Many more hotspots were trending, where local police were following up on leads. Tonight's meeting was a weekly occurrence where Rory and Lane pointed out marks that were trending on the software. Sometimes it was a cluster of homicides in a tightly focused location, or a group of homicides carried out with the same suspected weapon, or on the same type of victim. It might be how a body was disposed of. It could be the occupation of the victim. The algorithm tracked over 5,000 indicators looking for similarities. When they could make a strong enough case, Rory and Lane took their findings to the authorities in that area. With Lane's reputation as a forensic psychologist and criminal profiler for the FBI's Behavioral Science Unit, and Rory's credentials as a reconstructionist who pieced together the very findings the algorithm looked for, they made the perfect team. Police departments listened to their conclusions, and many had started using Lane's software to track homicides on their own.
"All of them were killed by some sort of blunt force trauma, blows to the side of the head, and then the bodies were disposed of in dumpsters."
They were in the process of logging the names of the 12 Detroit victims and cataloging their findings when the doorbell rang. Rory looked at her watch. It was almost 10 o'clock.
She walked to the front door and peered through the peephole. Ron Davidson stood on her porch. "Shit," she said before pulling the door open. "Hey, Ron."
"Gray," he said in a measured tone. "You're not returning my calls again."
Rory exhaled loudly. "Sorry, I've been busy with this thing for my dad."
"I've heard all about it since you asked me for those old records."
He leaned closer to the screen door.
"Christ, Gray, your dad repped this guy?"
Rory nodded. "Looks like it, yeah."
"Did the boxes from 1979 have what you needed?"
"Yes, or I'm not sure. I haven't been through them all yet." Her hand habitually moved to her face to adjust her glasses, but she realized she wasn't wearing them. She never did when she was alone with Lane. "Thanks for coming through on those."
"No problem. I owed you for taking Camille Bird's case."
The two stood without speaking for a moment, Detective Davidson on the front porch and Rory inside behind the screen door.
"Can I come in?" Ron asked.
"Yeah, sorry. Of course," Rory said, opening the door. She led her boss into the living room where Lane was still tapping away on his computer across from the roaring fire. "Lane," Rory said. "Ron's here. We've got to talk." Lane looked up.
"Ron, how are you?"
"Doing good, Doc."
The two shook hands.
"Sorry to interrupt," Ron said. "I'll just be a minute."
"No worries," Lane said. "In here," Rory said, walking Detective Davidson past the darkened den, where all her dolls stood on the shadowed shelves, and into her office. In addition to the three boxes from 1979 that rested by her desk, the contents of which were spread across the surface, Camille Bird's photograph also hung from the corkboard with the few scant notes Rory had made nearly 2 weeks ago about the autopsy findings.
"Walter Bird contacted me," Ron said. "He says he hasn't heard from you. He said he called a few times, but never got a call back. Sounds familiar."
"I don't have anything to tell him yet."
"Then tell him that, Rory, but tell him something."
"I feel like crap, Ron. I agreed to take the reconstruction, then my father died, and I've been tied up in dissolving his law firm and everything else I ran into. I haven't put many hours on the case."
"I'm sorry for the timing, Rory. I know you've got a lot on your plate."
Rory looked over at her desk and saw the remnants of her research from the 1979 case strewn across the surface. She remembered sitting at the desk a few nights before, stumbling across her father's notes and wondering what he had been doing for Thomas Mitchell throughout all the years he represented the man. Now she knew. "I'll get back to Camille Bird, I promise."
"Have you looked into it at all?"
"Just a glance," Rory said, remembering the night she'd paged through the medical examiner's report, the image of Camille's bruised and damaged throat sparking in her mind. Rory glanced over at the picture of Camille Bird on the corkboard. She felt the spidery tentacles of guilt crawl up her back. She had dreamt of Camille Bird 2 nights earlier, coming across her body as it lay in Grant Park. Rory had tried to apologize for ignoring the case, but the girl was dead and cold in her dream when Rory shook her. As she stared now at the photo and into the dead girl's eyes, Rory felt the urge to hide behind her thick-rimmed glasses, turn up the collar of her coat, and look away. "I'll put some hours on it."
"When?"
"Soon, I promise." Her phone rang from her back pocket. Rory held up a finger. "Sorry." She retrieved her phone and checked the number. Although not in her list of contacts, Rory immediately recognized the number. It had been burned into her memory the way everything else was. But this particular phone number held a greater significance than simply her remarkable memory. The last time she received a call from this extension, she had learned that her father was dead. Was it irony, Rory wondered, that she had also been with Ron Davidson when she had accepted the last call.
Celia, Rory said to her father's administrative assistant, is something wrong?
Oh, hello, Celia said, caught off guard.
No, nothing's wrong.
Well, I'm not sure. I have to see you. I have something of your father's that I'm not sure what to do with. Can we meet this week?
Rory spun through her schedule. She had to make the trip out to Thomas Mitchell's cabin, meet with Judge Boyle and the parole board for the final hearing, finish the legal paperwork to get her newest and only client out of jail, which was scheduled to happen in 1 week, get his finances in order, and now dedicate some time to Camille Bird's reconstruction. All of this while putting off the burning desire to start her own search for Angela Mitchell and figure out what had happened to her.
I'm swamped at the moment, Celia, Rory said. Knowing that her father's law firm was all but shut down and wrapped up besides the Thomas Mitchell affair. Can we put it off for a couple of weeks?
There was a pause before the soft voice answered. I really need to see you, Rory. She thought she heard quiet weeping.
Rory remembered Celia's tears dripping onto her neck when the woman had embraced her at her father's law office.
Yes, Rory said. Then we'll meet this week. I'll call you tomorrow to find the best time. She heard more sniffling and ended the call without waiting for confirmation. She placed the phone in her back pocket and looked at her boss.
Give me another week, Ron. In the meantime, I'll call Mr. Bird and give him an update.
The detective nodded.
Okay, but I need something soon, Rory. Something new, anything.
I'll have something to you by next week, she said. Chicago, November 1981. Frank Moore had tracked her genealogy, the best he could figure. If Angela Mitchell were alive, she would likely rely on friends or family. This was his hope, anyway. Because the other possibility, that she had disappeared on her own, presented an insurmountable obstacle he'd never be able to scale. How would he find her if she had simply vanished? What if she had left the state to hide in a corner of the country where no one would look? Based on what Frank knew about the woman, this was a very conceivable possibility. Angela Mitchell had been a loner her whole life, moving from her parents' custody as a child to an extended stint at a juvenile psychiatric hospital in downstate Illinois that lasted until she was released at age 18. From there, Frank's research got murky. Her parents had been out of the picture since she became a legal adult, and Frank's trip down to St. Louis to visit them had been fruitless. Angela Mitchell's parents hadn't seen or heard from her in years prior to her disappearance. They hadn't even known she married. The next time she showed up on Frank's sketchy timeline was when she met Thomas Mitchell in Chicago, had a short courtship, and then married. She had no close friends besides a woman named Catherine Blackwell, who was the wife of Thomas's former business partner. Frank's journey to the Blackwell residence had been unsuccessful, a little strange, and ultimately a waste of time and energy. Through the archival information he found at the library and some names given to him by Angela's parents, Frank had made a list of distant relatives to call on. These were cousins and siblings of her parents and cousins of her parents, and other further removed folks that had at one time or another been part of Angela's life before she met Thomas Mitchell. For the past 3 months, Frank had been looking for any hint that his client's wife was still alive, as Thomas Mitchell swore she was. A 28-year-old associate, Frank was anxious to prove himself at Garrison Ford. He filled his days by slogging through research and briefs, and occasionally making an appearance in court to assist the partner to whom he was assigned. He spent his nights hunting down a woman who was likely dead and buried. Newly married, with a nurse for a wife who worked the afternoon shift at the hospital, he had the time to look. He was happy being paid to chase a ghost. But God Almighty, he could only imagine what would happen if he actually found her. His client would be free, the conviction overturned,
and Frank's stock at Garrison Ford would rise quickly. Perhaps he'd make partner before 40. The latest lead was written on a scrap paper, a name and address, and stuck with scotch tape to his dashboard. The rural road, an hour and a half west of the city, was empty. Frank couldn't imagine there ever being much traffic this far out in the sticks, and he drove freely as the sun set in front of him. Cornfields stretched out on either side of the road as far as he could see. The once tall stalks were now cropped down to nothing. Large bales of hay, spun in tight spirals, studded the field in random patterns. He came to a T in the road, checked his map, and turned left. After another 3 miles, he eventually saw the top of the two-story building rising above the otherwise flat terrain. The campus sprawled out over many acres. In the middle of nowhere, the white structure looked like a prison. Frank was sure it felt that way to many of its patients. He turned into the parking lot and pulled past the sign indicating that he had arrived at Bayer Group Juvenile Psychiatric Facility. He found a spot and parked. Inside, he signed in.
"Which resident are you visiting?" the receptionist asked.
"No resident," Frank said, standing in his wrinkled suit after making the long drive from the Garrison Ford offices. "I'm here to see Dr. Jefferson."
"Do you have an appointment?"
"Yes, I called earlier in the week."
"Let me find him," the receptionist said.
Frank paced the waiting room for 5 minutes until the door opened.
"Mr. Moore?"
Frank turned around to see a thin man with tiny glasses and a long white coat.
"Dale Jefferson, we spoke on the phone."
"Yes," Frank said, walking over and shaking hands. "Thanks for taking a meeting."
"Sorry, it's not under better circumstances," Dr. Jefferson said. "Come back to my office."
Frank followed the doctor into the psychiatric facility, through a long white corridor and into his office. The space was decorated like a living room, a couch, coffee table, and 2 end chairs. A wall of built-in shelving held volumes of textbooks. Dr. Jefferson sat in one of the chairs and motioned for Frank to take a spot on the couch. A file was resting on the coffee table, and Dr. Jefferson picked it up as he sat.
"It's a terrible shame about Angela. I was unaware of the situation at first because the news media never used her maiden name. And sadly, Thomas Mitchell has gotten more attention than any of his victims. Society is more interested in the thief than the lives he stole."
Frank was not here to debate the psychology of society, and wasn't about to mention that his client was convicted of killing only one woman, not a slew of women. In fact, Frank hadn't mentioned his association with Thomas Mitchell to anyone he had encountered during his months-long search for Angela. The court of public opinion had pinned all the missing women from the summer of 1979 on Thomas Mitchell, and Frank knew he needed to hide his motives for why he was asking about a woman who had supposedly been killed more than 2 years ago.
"Yes,"
Frank finally said.
"It's a shame."
"You said Angela's family is looking into a civil lawsuit?"
"Yes,"
Frank said, crossing his legs. A poker player might see this as a nervous reaction to hide his lie.
"I'm looking into matters myself to see if a civil suit is possible, given the circumstances."
"You'll excuse me," Dr. Jefferson said. "The man must be very troubled. But if they're not going to put him to death for what he did, then I say lock him up for life and drain him of all his resources."
"Well,"
Frank said, clearing his throat,
"I'm going to see what I can do."
"Do you represent Angela's parents?"
Frank paused briefly.
"Yes."
"From what I remember, they didn't have a wonderful relationship with Angela. Always terrible to see fractured relations between parents and child. And now, never to be repaired."
"Yes, it's a shame,"
Frank said again.
"Do you have children, Mr. Moore?"
"I'm just married. Maybe in a year or two, my wife and I will try.
Dr. Jefferson held up the file.
What can I help you with?
Civil suits can be nasty, so I want to find out as much about Angela as possible. I know she spent time here during her teen years, and I'm wondering if I could ask a few questions.
Of course.
Frank removed a piece of paper from his breast pocket.
Angela came here in 1967 when she was 17 years old.
That's correct.
How long was Angela here?
7 months. She left on her 18th birthday.
I'm afraid we didn't help Angela as much as we or her parents had hoped.
So once she became an adult, she left on her own?
Yes. Their group is a juvenile facility. We only treat youths who are younger than 18 and under a parent's or guardian's supervision. Once they become legal adults, they stay only if they choose to do so. Angela did not.
And what was Angela admitted for?
Dr. Jefferson read from the file.
Oppositional defiant disorder, social anxiety, and obsessive compulsive disorder. She was also autistic, which complicated her treatment.
So when Angela turned 18 and you could no longer legally keep her here, her parents picked her up? Do you know what happened to Angela after her time here?
It wasn't her parents, Dr. Jefferson said. Like I mentioned, that relationship was fractured. During Angela's time here, I felt like we were making such poor progress that I suggested to her parents that perhaps Angela should be discharged and return when she had an attitude that might be more receptive to accepting help. Her parents were against discharging her. I'm afraid at that point they had reached the end of their patience with her.
Frank sat forward on the couch.
So what? They dumped her here?
Dr. Jefferson shrugged.
I wouldn't put it that way. They wanted to get Angela help, and they felt unable to help her on their own.
So she turns 18. You can't keep her here. Where did she go? Back with her parents?
Dr. Jefferson shook his head.
No. Angela was released of her own accord. She was legal at that point.
Yes, but she was just 18, with no job, no money, and I presume no transportation. Where did she go? She just walked out into the cornfields?
One of our counselors tried following up for a few weeks, but never heard back from her. The last address we had for her was in Peoria, Illinois.
What was in Peoria?
The best I remember, a friend of Angela's lived there. The friend signed in the day Angela was discharged, helped her pack her things. According to our records, Angela left with her.
Do you have a name for this woman?
Frank asked quickly, then paused to control his excitement. This was the first real lead he'd come across while searching for anyone who might be connected to Angela Mitchell during her adult years.
If she's a relative, we may be able to add her name to the civil suit.
Of course,
Dr. Jefferson said, paging through the file until he removed a single slip of paper and pushed it in front of Frank.
Last name was Schreiber. She was one of our on-call nurses. Not sure this is the correct address anymore. That was a number of years ago.
Chapter 22. Chicago, October 29th, 2019. They drove together and followed the car in front of them, which held the social worker and the parole officer. Thomas Mitchell had inherited the cabin in 1994 when his uncle died. Rory had tracked the property the best she could from her father's paperwork. The uncle had died of pancreatic cancer and had willed the cabin to his nephew. Rory's father had placed the cabin into a trust. A rental company had taken good care of the place, and according to the financial documents she found in the file, the property had provided a nice source of income over the years. It was a two-bedroom A-frame just outside of Starved Rock State Park, about an hour from the city. Located so close to the park and the Illinois River,
The cabin had been easy to rent over the years. The rental income had been self-sustaining and allowed the management company to stay current with upkeep. Rory's father had dismissed the management company the previous year and had carefully documented his monthly trips to keep the cabin updated, surely anticipating his client's arrival. When they reached the outskirts of Starved Rock, the social worker slowed in front of her. Rory assumed she was consulting her GPS. The lead car took off again, and Rory followed it through winding roads on the north side of the park. They traveled across bridges, where short waterfalls fell over bluffs and where evergreen pines rose up into the clear October sky. Had she not been on a journey to see the future home of a suspected serial killer, the setting would be majestic. After 15 minutes of slow going, stopping at each intersection before deciding which direction to turn, Rory and Lane arrived at the entrance to a long dirt driveway, canopied tightly by foliage that had started to morph to fall colors. A mailbox stood isolated, just to the side of the drive, and Rory figured she could check off at least one of the judge's requests. If anyone wanted to send the thief a letter, he'd receive it via the United States Postal Service. She turned onto the driveway and followed the social worker along the uneven path for 100 yards. The cocoon driveway eventually opened to a clearing in which stood a cedar-sided A-frame cabin. The piece of land was impressive. Rory's mind imagined an aerial view of the property, which was cut into a densely forested area. The clearing where the cabin stood was 5 acres of grass and gravel and clay that butted up against the thick forest around it. The end of the driveway led in a circle around the cabin. As Rory drove the loop around, she spotted the river through the trees off to her right. A path was cut in the forest, and a set of stairs led down to a dock that ran out into the water.
"Well," Lane said from the passenger seat, staring out his window, "you can't argue that this is anything but the perfect place for a suspected serial killer to hide for the rest of his life."
Rory shook her head. "And I was thinking how beautiful this place had been for the families that rented it all these years."
"No, you weren't. You wouldn't reconstruct deaths for a living if you were really thinking that."
Rory pulled around the cabin and parked. She grabbed her thick-rimmed glasses from the dashboard, put them on her face, and pulled her beanie hat down her forehead. "Yeah, you're right," she said, opening the car door. "This place is creepy as hell. Be right back." Rory climbed from the car and met Naomi Brown, the social worker, at the front of the cabin, inspecting the residence as she did. Rory had the key, which she had found in her father's office.
"Have you been to your client's home before?" Naomi asked.
"He's not my client, exactly," Rory said, shaking her head and adjusting her glasses. "No, I haven't seen the place." The social worker looked at Rory for a moment. It was the confused look Rory often received and always hated. Rory twirled her finger in the air and pointed at the cabin. "Let's get this out of the way."
"There is a list of requirements," Naomi said, "including a functional landline, a current U.S. Postal Service address, and other items. It's mostly a formality, but since the judge is agreeing to this unique living arrangement, we need to check all the boxes."
"Then let's check them," Rory said, as she climbed the steps to the front porch. The wooden boards creaked under her weight. She inserted the key in the door and pushed it open. Ezra Parker, the parole officer, snapped photos of the outside before entering. Inside, they found a well-kept home furnished the way any rental property might be, with a couch and chairs positioned around a stone fireplace in the front room. A kitchen was off to the left, and another room for dining. A screened-in porch on the back of the home offered a view of the sprawling acres that led to the forest, through which the river was visible and reflecting the October sky. Stairs led upstairs to 2 bedrooms. The group took 30 minutes to inspect the place. Naomi Brown checked all the boxes to show that the home met the judge's requirements. Ezra Parker snapped all the required photos. Until your client acquires an automobile, Naomi said, there is a convenience store half a mile down the road.
Rory nodded. She had a sudden desire to leave the place, realizing that her authority over Thomas Mitchell's finances would likely require her to help him with purchases, such as a car. As they headed to the front door, they noticed the red footprints they had all tracked in from outside. Rory looked down at her combat boots, noticing for the first time that they were covered in a crimson dust.
"Sorry about that," Naomi said. "We should have removed our shoes."
"What the hell is it?" Rory asked, lifting her foot to examine the bottom of her boot.
"Red clay," Ezra said. "It's common around Starved Rock. The soil is saturated with it. It gets everywhere. Your car will be a mess, too."
Rory looked at the blood-red footprints. "Time to go," she said. "I'll call someone to clean the cabin before his release." Chicago, November 1981. 3 days of phone calls had gone unanswered before Frank decided to make the drive out to Peoria and have a look himself. Angela Mitchell had been discharged from Bayer Group Juvenile Psychiatric Facility in 1968, 13 years ago, and it was very possible that whoever had once lived at the address Dr. Jefferson provided no longer did so today. But since it was his first legitimate discovery he'd come across while looking for any trace of Angela Mitchell in her adult life prior to marrying Thomas Mitchell, it was worth the drive. He made the trip on Saturday morning when traffic out of the city was light and the drive time was just over 2 hours. He drove past acres of harvested cornfields, not very different from his drive out to Bayer Group the other day. Tractors sat parked in the middle of the fields, and silos rose up occasionally on the otherwise flat horizon. When he turned onto a long stretch of two-lane road, address numbers were stenciled on roadside mailboxes situated next to long, stretching driveways that led to isolated homes nestled on large plots of land, each property far from its neighbors. He found the address that was listed in Angela Mitchell's file. The driveway was winding as he turned onto it. Dogs appeared from behind the house as he pulled his car to the end of the drive, barking and following the car as he came to a stop. Frank slowly opened the door. Two German shepherds greeted him and barked for his attention, both jostling to position their heads under his hand. He obliged by petting them while he stared at the farmhouse. The front door opened and a woman walked onto the porch. She stared down at him. Frank held up his hand in an amicable wave and walked toward her. The dogs barked and followed, jumping and leaning into his legs.
"They won't hurt you," the woman said from the porch. "Leave the man alone. Go on, get in the backyard."
The dogs barked and abandoned their playful assault and disappeared behind the house. Frank walked to the foot of the porch stairs.
"Ms. Schreiber, do I have the name right?"
As Frank approached, he got a better look at the woman, who he guessed was in her late 50s or early 60s.
"Yeah, that's me. What can I help you with?" she asked. "You selling encyclopedias or vacuum cleaners or some such?"
"No,"
Frank said with a laugh.
"My name is Frank Moore. I'm an attorney. I'm here to ask a few questions about Angela Mitchell, or Angela Barron, to use her maiden name. I believe you knew her?"
Frank saw the woman's face go slack. Her jaw loosened and her mouth opened. Her eyes widened as if Frank had pulled a gun from his waistband and pointed it at her. She took a step backward, her free hand reaching for the door handle. Frank lifted his hands.
"I'm just here to talk."
"I've got nothing to say. Now get off my property or I'll call the police."
"I'm not here to cause any trouble, ma'am. I'm looking into a civil lawsuit that might help Angela's family."
"I want you to leave my property."
Her eyes were wide and feral,
Right now!
The woman's demands turned the scene quickly into something Frank had not anticipated.
Okay,
Frank said, reaching into his pocket and pulling out his business card.
If you decide you want to talk about Angela, give me a call. My number is on this card.
Tubbs! Harold!
At the sound of their names, the dogs barreled from behind the house. This time, their demeanor was aggressive. Their playful yelps had morphed to growls. Frank dropped his business card as he backpedaled. The dogs nipped at his ankles as he hurried to his car, and then they bared their teeth with vicious snaps once he had locked himself inside. His forehead was slick with perspiration as he started the engine and glanced back to the front porch. The woman was gone, but Frank saw the curtains in the front window bend slightly. The white speck of his business card caught his eye. It was lying on the ground where he had dropped it. He pulled a U-turn and headed up the long drive and away from the barking dogs. He knew he had discovered something, but Frank Moore had no idea what it was. Chapter 23. Chicago, October 29th, 2019. The China doll rested on the passenger seat as Rory drove south out of the city. She took the Kennedy Expressway until it turned into I-94, then followed I-80 east for a short spurt to exit at Calumet Avenue. She pulled into the town of Munster, Indiana, 50 minutes after she left her house in Chicago. Three Floyd's Brewery was long closed when she turned into the parking lot. The last time she'd been to the brewery was in May for Dark Lord Day, a ticketed 12-hour event where stout lovers got the only chance of the year to buy their favorite beer. Rory attended because it was one of the rare public events she enjoyed, because beer flowed liberally and Lane had expressed interest. She didn't go for the reason everyone else did, to stock up on Dark Lord, although she did that too. For most regular folks, when their Dark Lord supply was gone, they had to wait until the next year to find more. Rory, thankfully, was not a member of the regular folk. She grabbed the doll from the passenger seat and stepped out of the car. Her breath was visible in the chilled night air. She pulled her beanie hat low on her head, adjusted her glasses, and started toward the building. The parking lot was lit by a single yellow halogen bulb at the top of the tall post in the middle of the parking area. As she walked along the blacktop, the golden glow of the halogen mixed with her still red footprints to create an orange trail away from her car. Rory noticed the strange footprints and stomped her combat boots to rid them of the last of the red clay that remained from Starved Rock earlier in the day. The memory of the blood-red prints she had tracked through the cabin gave her a shiver. Hence the trip to Munster to settle her nerves. Her fridge at home was empty. She walked to the side of the brewery and knocked on a gray metal door. It opened almost immediately.
"Rory the doll lady,"
the large man said. His thick beard dribbled down to his chest and was striped with gray. He wore a Three Floyds Brewing Company ball cap.
"You almost made it 6 months."
Rory had left Dark Lord Day in May with what most would consider a year's worth of stout. But she had been on hiatus for most of that time, and her alcohol consumption always increased when she was on a break. And the most recent developments in her life had caused her to prematurely run through the rest. "Kip," Rory said. "Always nice to see you." She held up the doll. "Simon and Helbig. It's German, rare, and in pristine condition." The large man took the doll and inspected it like he knew what he was looking at. He stroked his long beard.
"Can I find this at Walmart?"
"Not a chance."
"Taylor's been begging for one. She heard about the doll I gave Becky over the holidays."
Rory knew Kip had handfuls of grandchildren, always looking to one-up his rival grandparents at birthdays and Christmas time. Restored China dolls had been his go-to gift for the past 2 or 3 years.
They were rare and expensive and could not be one-upped by his competition. Rory wasn't sure what she'd do when Kip ticked off all his granddaughters to charm with her rare dolls. She'd have to ration her dark lord like everyone else. Until then, she bartered.
"Retail?"
Kip asked. Rory shrugged. "Probably 400."
"And what are you asking?"
2 cases.
"Straight up?"
Kip asked. "I'm feeling generous." Kip stroked his beard once more while he looked at the Zimone and Halbig doll.
"You got papers on it?"
"Come on," Rory said, reaching into the pocket of her gray coat and producing the original papers describing the doll. She'd picked it up the previous year at auction for next to nothing. It had been in terrible condition, with multiple fractures running through the porcelain and clumps of missing hair. Rory had expertly managed the fractures, erasing them to near invisibility. She relied on Aunt Greta to come up with a solution for the bald patches on the skull, which, of course, the old lady did. When Rory handed the doll over tonight, it looked brand new. Had she returned to the same auction hall where she found it, unloading it would bring a payday far north of $400. Kip nodded as he took the papers.
"Be right out."
A few minutes later, they walked across the parking lot. Kip pushed a dolly with 2 cases of stout stacked on it. He loaded them into Rory's car and closed the trunk. Rory climbed behind the wheel and started the engine. She rolled down the window when Kip knocked.
"You walk through a pumpkin patch on your way here?"
Kip asked, looking at the orange lunar-like footprints around the car. "Not a pumpkin patch," Rory said, pushing her glasses up her nose. "But a real freaking mess, that's for sure." She attempted a smile. "It's why I'm here at midnight. Let's just leave it at that."
"Yeah. When I got your call, I figured you were in bad need of a fix."
"It's beer, Kip, not heroin."
"A fix is a fix."
Kip reached into his coat pocket and pulled out a bottle of Dark Lord, frosted from having come straight out of the cooler. He produced a Swiss Army knife from his other pocket. The Dark Lord emblem was inscribed across the front of it. Peeling it open, the double side blade shined on one side with the sharpness of a scalpel. The other side sported a bottle opener. Kip popped the cap and handed it to Rory through the window.
"Watch yourself on I-80. Goddamn state troopers got eagle eyes."
Rory smiled and took the ice-cold bottle. "Thanks, Kip. I'll see you in May."
"Here,"
he said, handing her the Swiss Army knife as well.
"I know that doll's worth more than a couple of cases of beer."
Rory nodded her thanks, then pulled out of the brewery's parking lot and onto Indiana Parkway. A few minutes later, she was on the highway with her cruise control set at 1 mile per hour slower than the posted speed limit. She sipped her Dark Lord and enjoyed the ride back to the city. Rory found herself parked in front of her father's house. It was close to 1 in the morning. She was becoming unhealthily fixated on the woman from 1979. Angela Mitchell had somehow reached back across the years to grab hold of some part of Rory's consciousness. Like a tuning fork that has been tapped, the vibration from the mystery surrounding the woman was at once barely audible but yet impossible to ignore. At first, she failed to understand why Angela Mitchell had such a hold on her. Or, at least, Rory wouldn't admit it. To do so required self-reflection and the acknowledgement of her own flaws and idiosyncrasies. Bearing her soul had always been difficult, even if she were doing so only to herself. The connection had started when Rory learned that Angela was autistic. The link had strengthened when Rory read the descriptions that painted Angela as an introverted woman on the outskirts of society. Someone who never truly fit in and who had few, if any, close relationships in her life. A woman who had been too scared to go to the authorities even when she suspected her husband was a killer. Since she had learned that Catherine Blackwell believed Angela Mitchell could still be alive, Rory's mind was in overdrive. That her father had once searched for her, and perhaps had spent much of his life looking, had produced an unhealthy obsession with Angela Mitchell. From the low vibration in her mind, a single question formed. What did her father find? It was too much for Rory to neatly pack away, compartmentalize, and forget about. Rory knew she would use all her skills and talent to reconstruct Angela's whereabouts. She climbed from her car and strapped her backpack over her shoulder. Opening the trunk, she grabbed a second Dark Lord from one of the cases, and then used her key to enter her childhood home. A wave of emotion suddenly washed over her. Rory couldn't remember the last time she cried. In fact, she was unsure if she had ever experienced the emotion during her adult life. She didn't think so, and wasn't about to start now just from walking across the threshold to her childhood. Her father was gone. He had carried with him a great secret. It was enough for her to be curious. Crying would produce nothing useful. She closed the door behind her, walked into her father's office, and sat behind his desk. She used Kip's Swiss Army knife to pop the top on her stout and looked around the darkened room. Rory's greatest gift was her ability to piece together cold cases, to pore over the facts and discover things other investigators missed until a picture of the crime, and sometimes the perpetrator, became clear in her mind. Her understanding of a killer's thinking and motive came from examining the carnage he left behind. The frustration with attempting to reconstruct anything about Angela Mitchell lay in the fact that there had been nothing left behind. Thomas Mitchell left no carnage, and this made Rory wonder about the man's guilt. Was it possible, she asked herself, that he had spent 40 years in jail for a crime he didn't commit? The more puzzling dilemma was whether he had spent decades in jail for a crime that had never happened. She clicked on the desk lamp in her father's office and pulled Lane Phillips's thesis from her backpack. He had written it for his dissertation more than a decade ago. It was a dark and ominous look into the minds of convicted killers. A tour de force that came from Lane's 2-year crusade, during which he personally interviewed more than 100 convicted serial killers around the world. The thesis still echoed in the hallways of the FBI, even though Lane had long ago moved on from his time as a profiler there. It was also Rory's go-to reference material when she needed to remind herself how to think like a killer, a useful technique when trying to piece together a crime. Rory took a sip of Dark Lord and turned to the cover page. Some Choose Darkness by Lane Phillips. She'd read the thesis many times and was always drawn to the same section. She turned to it now. The heading always put a flutter in her chest. Why Killers Kill. She read Lane's discernments on what made a person choose to end another's life. The rationalizing that occurred, the blocking of emotion, the pouring of societal norms and moral obligations into a black hole of the mind. This concept got back to the core of his thesis. At some point in every killer's existence, a choice is made. Some choose darkness, others are chosen by it. Rory finished her beer while she sat in her dead father's darkened office. She looked around her childhood home, the quiet of the empty rooms allowing her mind to form the questions that gnawed at her. She thought about Angela Mitchell. She wondered if the mysterious woman had chosen darkness all those years ago, or if darkness had chosen her. Chicago, November 1981. Frank Moore continued to keep his hunt for the ghost of Angela Mitchell to himself, sharing none of his investigation with his bosses at Garrison Ford, and he hadn't yet mentioned anything to his wife. He had been named lead counsel for Thomas Mitchell's appeals, a task he was handling with efficiency and skill. Frank had kept private the fact that the man had hired him to look for his dead wife.
He had received the request with confusion and suspicion, but since his bizarre encounter at the farmhouse in Peoria, and perhaps for the first time, Frank considered that Angela Mitchell might actually be alive. He sat at his desk at Garrison Ford, the phone to his ear. Next to him was the thick folder of research. It held all the information he had collected thus far on Angela Mitchell, her troubled adolescence, her stint at Bayer Group Juvenile Psychiatric Facility when she was 17 years old, and Frank's conversation with Dr. Jefferson. The file ended with the address of the farmhouse in Peoria, and the name of the woman who had driven Angela from Bayer Group the day she discharged herself on her 18th birthday, Margaret Schreiber. He spent a week researching the woman. His phone calls to the county and the literature he had managed to obtain from public records told him that she had owned the home for 11 years. She held a mortgage and was current on her taxes. She was a certified nurse midwife at the local hospital in Peoria. Over the past few days,